So I'm Andrew, and I'm on campus because my wife Melissa
Dr.
is a
Verhey.
friend. Dr. Verhey is a French teacher, and we've been there for about 7 years. We have been at Princeton for most of our adult life. We met in grad school. I have a PhD in physics, and I graduated in 2014, so that was a while ago. But I had a a mix of jobs. All of the jobs were data science positions. So of course the data science field has evolved. I was consulting for almost 5 years. So that was a professional consulting. And then I was also having a more like a research data science position at Princeton. They have a Center for Statistics and Machine Learning, where I have a fellowship for 3 years. And then I joined Google, where I've been for, well, 2.5 years, 2.5 years now, yeah. So that's about me. And yeah, thanks for chatting with me.
Of course. Okay. So you kind of talked about your experience already, but more like of it at Google. So could you like describe more of your experience at Google and like any of the ongoing projects you're working on?
So at Google, I currently work for ads, and as you know, biggest part of Google revenue is ads. I think it's above 80%. And I'm on a team that is actually mostly working on developing a strategy for ads product. And what that means is that we are understanding user behavior and changes. And what that means is that we analyze how users use the web, what's available on the web, how user use mobile apps, et cetera. Because when you in our digital life, we need ads everywhere. Of course, Google is an advertiser. I think maybe since a number of years, I think Google realized that our ad business is actually kind of shrinking relative to competitors. If you think about, the advent of Facebook or TikTok, those platforms are full of ads. The advertisement is much more aggressive than Google ever was, and that kind of prompted the constantly reevaluating the strategy of how to help people monetize the content with ads, without being overly aggressive. So I think that's the role of my team, and we inform the product managers who develop those ad products, and that pertains to the ad formats, like how are they presented, essentially like how to target the ads, like how to make sure that the ads are relevant to users. So there are various, I would say, parts of the job, but the main, I think, underlying question is the long-term strategy of ads on Google products. Yeah. I actually, so to be perfectly honest, I haven't worked for ads for all the time. When I joined Google, I worked for Google Assistant that is now become Gemini, the AI app. When I joined, it was like a month before ChatGPT was released, and this entirely just changed like the entire game. Google was developing for quite a while like a more conversational assistant, and there was an internal team called Lambda. And at that time, I think this team was kind of going nowhere. I think the perception at Google was that these conversational chatbots, they make stuff up. They are not trustworthy. Nobody will ever trust this. All the use cases that we had at the time were kind of like pushed. It's not gonna work. That team that was developing Lambda on a system was about to just stop existing. People were just moving to different teams. I think for Google specifically, the ChatGPT release was extremely uncomfortable because the perception at Google was that this is not going to work. We don't like it. And honestly, I would say that that kind of perception is still present. I think there among Googlers, the perception of AI is quite mixed. And of course, you know, the train is the part of the station. The AI is rolling into like all of our products and plenty of our, you know, it affects how we work and what we work on, et cetera. So it affects almost all aspects of our work. Yeah, I would say that the resistance was quite strong. I think now it's maybe a little less.
Yeah, so you mentioned that like the perceptions on AI are like very mixed, very different. What would you say Google's overall approach to AI is now, especially with like,
It's a great question. I would say Google's approach to AI is actually quite aggressive at the time. And I think that the Google, you know, the main Google product, which is the Google Search, that, you know, we used to know and love. And I think, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people loved it. And I think nowadays, when people talk about, the most common opinion is that, oh, Google search quality is going down. And I think there are various reasons. And of course, internally, people are very much aware of it. I think the reasons are few fold. First of all, the queries that we give to Google search are becoming longer and longer. We actually expect technology to be able to answer more complex questions. And so that drives the change to like how the queries are being understood. They are first being parsed to like an intent model, and then some sort of, you know, action is being taken on those user queries. So that's one thing. The queries that people ask Google are constantly changing, and they are becoming longer over time. The other thing is that the underlying internet is also changing. I think that what's available online has changed quite dramatically. I think we are past the era of, you know, personal blog posts where there was some great content. Now, you know, if we search for information, we're going to search like Wikipedia or Reddit or YouTube or some specific kind of site. I think that the internet has changed, and I think, you know, that the fact that Google search doesn't work as great is the reflection of the larger kind of change in the digital world. The approach to AI is quite, very, very strong, because, you know, almost immediately once, you know, the AI kind of revolution started, internally we had those, now they're called AI overviews, this little feature that often for many queries you get, instead of like, you know, links, or instead of like a snippet of a website with some short information that's called a web answer, is now being replaced with an AI overview. So we had that feature very, very early on. It was called Magi. It was hallucinating like crazy. So before it was released, it was of course massaged, and there were a lot of types of queries for which it was completely ineligible. For example, if you ask about, I don't know, like medical symptoms, then it would be automatically turned off. And nowadays, actually, it is actually going to reply to medical queries as well. So I think as the trust in how these AI-powered features work increases, then they are being put on into more and more queries. So we had AI overviews. Now they are very common. Now we have the AI search mode, which is experimental. I think it's where instead of maybe like back in the day, you would search for something, click on some link, search for something else, click on some link, try to do the information and do a lot of this personally and by hand. So it tries to mimic that thought process, and whenever you ask for something, it executes a number of search queries and even gives you a count, and obtains the information and provides an AI-based summary of what it reads. So I think this is definitely an approach to change how we interact with the internet. And I know that ad, because I work for ads, like people are quite terrified because all of these searches that you visit a website, and whenever you visit a website, there's an internal auction. Let's say, Andrew of age 40 who lives in, Lawrenceville, is visiting this website, and there's an auction. Like, who wants to show him an ad? And for what price? So all these, if this is happening all in the background, and AI is doing all the searching and all the information gathering, then all these ad space just disappears, and presumably it's going to change how the entire business is going to work. So yeah, the approach is, I think it's inevitable, but yeah, it's happening quite fast, yeah.
Thank you for that response. Kind of building off of that response, so you mentioned like people trusting AI and AI information more. How do you think that trust and dependency will sort of feed into like an AI, alleged like AI bubble burst? Or what advancements, like you said, AI search queries, search mode, what advancements do you think has the most potential to impact society or like in different disciplines like healthcare, education, or like sustainability, environment, etc.
It's very interesting what you're saying, that I think you're thinking about like a long-term impact. And to be honest, I don't think anybody is thinking about this. And I'm glad you are, and I'm glad that the young generation is asking these questions, because I have a feeling that actually people don't ask about this enough. And of course there are voices of like, yeah, what about hallucinations? What if it causes problems? What if misinformation propagates, and we trust those tools too much? And I think that the reason why I would say maybe people just gloss over this is because the internet was full of misinformation to begin with. And it's not really new to get information that's like false or misleading. So I think what I'm, and of course people are very bad at predicting the future, and of course I am also very bad at predicting the future. But I think we will likely get used to those errors, and I think. The tools such as, I would say that they often are just too good to not use. And I initially was kind of skeptical, definitely when I was, let's say, I was maybe working on some computer code, and we have all these tools that help you just write, it suggests the code that you should write. And I was thinking like, it's too aggressive, it's a bit distracting. But with time, it got better, and like I started using it. And you know, instead of writing the code myself, which kind of would know how to do, I would just write a prompt like, use this data set, compute, the medians, use compute confidence intervals using this and this method, and provide a concise summary. And then it generates the code that does this. And of course, like I would go through it, especially if the results don't make sense. But yeah, there are places where I think the tools just become useful. And I think those tools are likely to stay. There are parts where AI just is not so great. It doesn't have eyes. So if you ask it to like make a graph that looks good, it's no idea what that means. And of course, like what looks good is could be personal, but it fails spectacularly when I try to do something like this. So yeah, I mean, I have to another example of how AI is just taking a lot of space is that I've been maybe a week ago on a train coming back from New York City, and I was sitting next to a lawyer. And the lawyer was using ChatGPT to write immigration applications. I remember 10 years ago I've been applying for a green card myself, and this process was pretty stressful, and you would definitely want to make sure that the lawyer does a good job. But I think it's a mundane task and repetitive. I think types of replies that work, and this type of work is being automated. And I kind of have a feeling that perhaps the lawyer himself might have a feeling that like if AI is doing a lot of your work, that work perhaps doesn't really matter all that much anymore. So I think we all kind of feel a little bit of uncomfortable that like the more AI you use, I feel like and perhaps what I do is irrelevant. So I think that there is some natural resistance. Like I want to do stuff myself to feel useful, but I think the tools that we use also kind of question the value of our work, and it's often uncomfortable.
Thank you for your response. So I wanted to transition like actually to the conference, like in Mountain View. I heard.
Oh yeah.
Sure. You were there, correct?
Yeah, I was there. So I was there on a data science summit. So Google is a huge organization, just like one out of 80,000 people. Mm. And actually, there might be maybe like to back it up. The data scientist's role is understood differently in various places, and at Google. It actually is not gonna be the machine learning engineering kind of type of role where you I did part of that, but where you train the models, evaluate the data, see how the large language models improve. Data scientists are often actually employed in areas of measurement figuring out how and what to measure. So they often come with backgrounds in statistics and natural sciences, where of course we do plenty of measurements. We do hypothesis testing. And so I went to a data science summit, and there's only about 1,000 data scientists in an entire Google. So it's not a huge team. But I think people, I would say, do statistically very interesting analysis, including myself. And the most important or like difficult analysis are those about causal inference, where distinguishing correlation from causation is extremely difficult and not always possible. And In fact, this is not a dead field, and statisticians are working quite intensely building those causal inference frameworks. But this is maybe like a bit niche, and that's what data scientists actually do. And somehow, sometimes maybe this is like not expected. That's what they do. Yeah. So the conference, the Google I/O, it's like a annual conference. It's a promotional event. It's of course, you know, streamed and people, you know, prepare for months and rehearse. And I think what's being shown at that conference does not necessarily exist or will actually function. I remember a few years ago, there was a pretty controversial a demo shown at this conference where a person talked using Google Assistant. That's why I know about this. And to book a haircut appointment. And the AI was doing the talking. On the other hand was like a hairdresser salon. And the conversation finished, they booked an appointment, everything was happy. And the backlash was tremendous because apparently they're on the receiving end, the hair salon, a person had no idea that they are talking with an AI. And that caused a lot of troubles. And that feature, I think, exists. It's called Duplex, but I think it's completely niche and hasn't been developed, and it's not something that is in common use. So the purpose of this conference is to show interesting things that Google is working on that has some viable use cases for and can show it off. It's not necessarily that this is the next thing that this is going to be become a big product or a big thing. One of the developments presented at this year's I/O conference was a virtual reality platform for Android. And internally we have our internal memes and everything, and people were kind of like asking, why are we doing this? We had the Apple already had this VR headset that was a flop, and are we just trying to like fail again and do the same thing? I think the I/O this year, as well as like the last 2 years, was 100% focused on AI, on the new developments in search, and also in real-time translation that I found kind of cool. It is a promotional event just to make people excited and kind of trying to get a glimpse of like, what is going to be available in the nearby future, maybe not yet now, but like in the nearby future. I think what was different this year is that there was no hardware presented whatsoever. Google used to produce like Pixel phones, which I have for work, and like earbuds and tablets and whatnot. And I think they still do. But I think this has no longer been mentioned. And I think Google perhaps dropped the ball on making hardware, which I know personally, I think is perhaps a good decision because we were never very good at this and never like, it wasn't a priority of anybody. So it was there, but it wasn't very good.
Yeah, I also noticed that there wasn't like a single like phone or like computer or
something. Yeah, there was no Pixel 9. There was
It was just all mostly like AI technologies. So out of all of these like AI gadgets and technologies that were presented there, what would you say were like your favorite advancements, or what was like the most interesting to you?
Well, something that, and I discussed this with, with Dr. Verhey, who's a French teacher, is of course, the real-time translation tool, and how this is advertised is that there's when you are in a video call with a person who speaks a foreign language, the translation can happen in real time, and also using your voice as an input to kind of, to modify like whether you're like agitated, whether you speak softly or fast or hard or with a lot of questioning. So I think it's trying to capture the more of like the emotional state of a person talking in order to influence the translated voice to speak with the same kind of manner. And I think it feels kind of gadgety. Like it feels like there's going to be a lot of processing power to make that work for like very kind of little benefit. I think it, to me it's interesting how far the translation goes. But also like on the other hand, I was chatting with with my wife about the translation cannot be done always that fast because sometimes you need to. Because the language is not a one-to-one mapping, so you can't immediately translate everything because you sometimes may need to like say a full sentence in order to figure out what they are actually saying and how to then translate this into another into another language. But I think this is in the future. This is maybe personal. Like I wish some, diversity of languages, would persist. And even like a few days ago, I was talking with one of my colleagues, and they said like, "Oh, we have this like email from a publisher in France," and "Oh, I can actually like read a little bit of French, so I can just read it without translation," and that was kind of helpful, and maybe like feel good about that. Oh, I can actually read a little bit in a foreign language. I think because so much of the development is AI, I don't know if you guys use Notebook LM. It's this it's the application that lets you drop a corpus of documents and then question that corpus of documents. I think a lot of the AI development feels very fast. Let me just if I were to kind of summarize this, I think many of like I would say professionals in like mid-career as I am are kind of maybe waiting for like how is it gonna pan out because it's so difficult to like predict what's gonna happen. I think for you who are high school students and will have to like choose what you do in college, I think that actually is perhaps harder because predicting the future is just as hard, and I think you have to like decide on like on the track of your your education very soon. I kind of empathize with this, and I think that the world hasn't been changing like that fast in a while. I think we've been discussing this on a summit recently, is that the internet became popular in the late 90s of the 20th century, where you perhaps haven't been born yet. But I think how it started is that there was this content on the internet. It was in various domains, and that necessitated to create browsers and search engines so that you can just search and rank all the relevant websites and present them to the user. So you have to do the searching to kind of organize. And I think Google did a great job in just organizing this very kind of messy and distributed system that's internet. And I think that was maybe a while ago. I think where we are now, or maybe prior to AI, is that plenty of content is algorithmically like provided. We often spend time on like these, we call this walled gardens platforms like YouTube or Facebook or TikTok, the kind of platforms that like try to keep you in so that, you know, you can get your news on YouTube, you can get your entertainment on YouTube, or et cetera. So, and what's being provided to you is kind of algorithmically presented. So things that you might find relevant, et cetera. So it's not really you kind of doing the searching yourself, but there's some system that, you know, delivers and feeds you the information. And I think with the advent of AI, what we see is might be happening is that the content is not even going to be algorithmically like provided. It's just going to be generated on the fly. And we see an advent of you know, uses of this technology that I think are quite mind blowing and somewhat like concerning at the same time. One of the most used mobile application in AI is not ChatGPT. It's character.ai, which is a bit of like a gamified platform where you can create a character with certain properties and just talk to it. So, and a lot of those trends are, you know, going to be driven by you know, younger generation. So yeah, I think the fact that AI is like changing so much in terms of like how we interact in the digital world, it is hard to wrap our heads around, and you know, it's interesting and kind of concerning at the same time.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was really comprehensive. You mentioned like sort of predicting the future is always like really hard, and it's especially hard because of the speed at which the current market and industry is evolving. Do you see any really valuable advice that you would give to like high school students or even undergrad students pursuing like data science or machine learning? What skills did you think were really valuable for you, and how do you think that's changed right now?
I think like the underlying, so I think that there are these hard skills and the soft skills. And the hard skills, you know, when I was young, was, you know, programming, statistics, physics, and math. And I think those you have in school, and I think it's great to kind of have them. But once you are in a professional world, I think everybody is different, of course. And I think what kind of I found the most valuable, that the skill that was helping me just, you know, always, you know, be a useful part of any team, is curiosity. And the curiosity meaning like the world is very complex and it's not going to get any easier. But the curiosity to like understand how the complex systems work, and it can be applied to just about anything. You know, if you, LLMs are completely, you know, very difficult systems that we don't fully understand. But I think the more like, you know, curiosity about how the system works you have is great. And I think here, like in ads, what we are trying to always understand is like, how do these ads even work? It's been 25 years of development of various techniques of how to do that. And we still live with those systems for some of them. And in the digital world, like pretty much everything of like how, you know, YouTube ranks the songs to play, it has grown from years of some development. And I think the kind of curiosity to like be willing to understand this is always appreciated, because those systems are complex, and there's not a single person that actually understands the whole of it. So maybe that's part of that might be that kind of skill might be useful in this, you know, huge organization where things are tremendously complex and appreciating the complexity is. But of course, hard skills are always just fun because you have like a feeling that you understand something, and you know, understanding, you know, being able to, you know, train your own LLM from scratch, or you know, build a you know, a machine learning model that, I don't know, predicts how much water you should drink or whatever. I think that kind of curiosity about like understanding how these things work is always very useful, and it's also like pleasant to learn. I think having a personal understanding is never always feels good, even if it's not immediately useful. But I think that curiosity, underlying curiosity, actually kind of like served me well. But hard skills, I don't know what hard skills are going to be needed exactly. So this is a gamble. I'm not sure what. Definitely, programming is still, I think, is still gonna be okay. Statistics and data science for sure is gonna be, you know, there for a while.
Okay, I think the meeting's actually like about to end, so I wanna first of all thank you so much for.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a good evening, everyone.
You too. Bye. Bye-bye.